You might just give up because it's just about you. It's like getting old. People get old, right? And they get to a certain age, you know, their friends have died. Maybe their wife has died. Maybe their husband has died. Maybe their kids have died. They start to just give up. You know what I mean? They just give up. But I had something to fight for, and it was, I had something to live for, and it wasn't just for me. It was something for far greater than just me. You could say 14, 15, 16, then Nas's Greatest Hits came out. So I bought that. You know what I mean? But I would watch his videos all the time, and I'd emulate him. So then when I was 17 years of age and I finally sent him, you know, a cassette video with some of my highlights, he was like, "How is there a kid in Australia that fights just like me?" And so grateful to be there for my wife and my son. It means the world to me that God has given me another opportunity at life. And I'm just trying to, you know, grab that with both hands and just, you know, cling on to the you know, onto the rope of life, you know what I mean? So I'm just grateful to be here, man.
Hello and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oleicott was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
Just, you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, "Well, let's pull you back."
And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
His winning and his nothing else.
Hello and welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week I'm delighted to have a story that reaches far beyond our own little narrow world of boxing, and I'm joined by former IBF featherweight champion Billy Dibb, who less than 2 weeks ago was told he no longer has cancer and he is in remission. The boxing world has got behind Billy during his fight, and what a fight it has been. If you haven't followed his journey on social media, you should. It's been incredible, and thanks to Billy for sharing that journey here. Billy, as you will find out, knows a lot about the worst that life can throw at him. He was bullied as a kid, his first wife died of cancer, he's faced these struggles, and at times he's been snookered by boxing politics. But boxing pales into his insignificance when you're talking about life and death matters. If you haven't listened to the recent episode with cancer survivor and matchmaker Robert Diaz, I'd recommend it, and there's nothing like these kind of stories to make you realize that there's so much more to life. I hate it when big fights don't happen. I hate the promotional rows when fighters fail drugs tests, when the wrong fighter is given a decision and all that stuff. But this is real life. Billy is a wonderful guest, and I'm so pleased we got this done. If you enjoy Boxing Life Stories, you can support me on Patreon at patreon.com/TrisDixon. For my regular video updates slash rants, you get early access to episodes, both Boxing Life Stories and Ringside Rewind with me, Ian Dark, and John Rawling. And there's often something interesting going up there. It helps self-employed content creators like myself make a living, and your support is hugely appreciated. And before I leave you with Billy, huge thanks to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. Blaz and the gang were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. And now here's Billy Dibb. So, Billy, big question. I mean, how's things? It's been a busy couple of weeks for you.
Yeah, man. Look, things are good, man. I'm on the mend. I'm on that journey of healing the soul, you know what I mean? So after being what I've been through, you know, it takes a little bit of time to sort of start to feel human again, man. So it's good to start to feel like I'm on the mend, and I'm getting better day by day.
When you say that, is it a mental and physical process? Is it physically you've been drained from the treatment and the therapy, and emotion you've been drained because you've kind of, you know, in some ways, I suppose, in the back of your mind somewhere, even if you've not wanted to give up, you've been counting like your blessings and counting the amount of days you got left and all the rest of things.
Man, that's exactly what it is. You know, it's just that right now I'm just so grateful to be alive and so grateful to be there for my wife and my son. It means the world to me that God has given me another opportunity at life. And I'm just trying to, you know, grab that with both hands and just, you know, cling on to the, you know, onto the rope of life, you know what I mean? So I'm just grateful to be here, man.
So congratulations, not just for the diagnosis, but you're one of the very few men who's united boxing.
you know, it's such a divisive sport with people on A sides and B sides and all the rest of it, but everyone in the sport's been pulling for you. Have you felt that?
Definitely, man. The love and support has been absolutely phenomenal from some of the greatest champions, past and present. You know what I mean? Just to name a few, you know, you got Badu Jack, an absolute gentleman. You know, Devin Haney, you know, like just some of the most unbelievable human beings to you know, to take time out of their busy schedules to check in on me and to make sure that I'm doing okay. That meant the world to me.
So can you tell me the process of how you got the good news a couple of weeks ago? Like, did you go to the doctors and is that where you were told, or did an envelope come in the mail, or like how did it come?
We woke up early in the morning, my wife and I, really early, like probably around 5 a.m. We prayed to God, and then you know, we woke up my son at around 7:30. We got dressed, we headed to the hospital, and I had to do a what you call is a PET scan. And this PET scan is a machine that you basically go into. It scans your body, and then it gives them about 6,000 photos, and they go through these 6,000 photos. You got to wait some time. So, you know, for me, it was a pretty excruciating wait, because I contacted the hematologist to let him know that I finished the scan and that I was looking forward to the result. And he pretty much said to me, look, I won't be able to give you any results till tomorrow. So I was pretty devastated, you know, with that news. I was thinking, how am I going to get through another night without knowing whether I've got cancer or not, you know? So then thankfully, I don't know what changed in his schedule, but he kind of rang me a few hours later and said, listen, I can't talk for too long, but I just want to let you know, congratulations, you're cancer-free, you're in remission. I was like, you're joking. And he goes, I'm not joking. He goes, but I got to go. I said, Dr. Bhattacharya, before you hang up, can I ask you a quick, can I tell everybody? He goes, tell whoever you want. You're clear, mate. So I come upstairs and I said to my wife, I said, Barry, I just got off the phone with the hematologist. I'm cancer-free. I'm in remission. And she's like, you're joking. I'm like, I'm not joking. I'm telling you the truth. And we just hugged it out, shed a few tears. My son was really happy, you know what I mean? So, like, you know, and then that's how we revealed it. We just decided, you know what, it'd be really cool to write it on a piece of paper. My dad is in remission, you know what I mean? And that's what we did. You know, we wrote down. My son was so happy to hold it and just jump around and tell the world that I was in remission and cancer-free.
Geez, because that's not – relief doesn't even cut it, does it? Relief's not even a word that's, you know, feeling relief. It's not the same thing, is it? It's like a whole different perspective on everything forward, isn't it?
It's not even about relief, you know, because the thing is that, you know, you could beat the cancer and then you could make your way outside, you know, to jump in your car and somebody could run you over in a horrific way. I mean, you die in a horrific accident. So, like, you know, it's not even about that, but just so grateful for that little bit of time. You know, God gave me more time. Because, you see, I'm a true believer in the faith of Islam, you know what I mean? And nothing's promised. We're not promised today or tomorrow, you know what I mean? We're not promised that we're going to sleep tonight, wake up tomorrow morning. I'm a realist. I understand that, you know what I mean? Because people have died in certain ways, and I understand that God can take you at any moment. So I'm just grateful for each and every moment that I have in this world, and I try to use my time, you know, in by doing good. That's what's important to me now.
So I appreciate the fact that you've sort of surrendered yourself to religion and you have those beliefs. But you've had more than your fair share through your life. And I'm sure we'll get to it. But has your faith ever wavered? Because there's got to be times where you say, well, why me? Why me? What have I done?
I'll be honest with you. I've never ever in my life said, why me? And you know that I've been through a lot. You know, I lost world title fights where I begged God that I wanted to be victorious. You know, I've seen tragedy. I've witnessed tragedy. And then I go through my own sort of, you know, situation.
Brush with death, yeah.
A lot of people would say, why me? But you know what, Tris, I never said that, because I always say, why not me? What makes me any better than anybody else has gone through? Why? Because I won a couple of world titles? Why? Because who am I? I'm just a human like everybody else. You know what I mean? I'm just a human that's achieved a few things. But let's be honest. You know, when I get to heaven, if I do get to heaven, God willing, You know, you think God's going to care that I won one world titles? He's not going to care about that. That doesn't make me any better than anybody else. So God, he's given me this platform to shed light on, you know, and to maybe inspire people and to be a good person. You know, I've been definitely tested through my life. But I accept the test because it gives you strength, you know what I mean? And it allows you to be a strong individual. And I feel like God set me up for something really big. And I feel like my journey is only just beginning now. You know, like I'm going to become one of the best keynote speakers. My goal is to become one of the best keynote speakers in the world. I aim to be better than Tony Robbins, Anthony Robbins, all these guys. I want to be better than all of them. I want to travel the world and you know, inspire the world to get through their hardships and to know that, you know, through faith, through trusting the process, that things do happen. You know, good things come to good people.
There was obviously a viral clip of you on a TV show in America, in Australia, that went out 2 or 3 weeks ago, just before you had your diagnosis, and you were talking about, you know, wanting to be there for your son and that kind of stuff. Has there been a main part of your thought process over the last few months? Have you been thinking back and looking back over your experiences and the times you've had, or were you thinking about what was coming and what you might miss, or was it a blend of everything?
It wasn't about what I was going to miss. It was about what my son was going to miss. That was what was killing me, you know? That was the only thing that was like, from the moment that I got sick, I remember the first thing that I said to my mum was, "Mum, I can't leave my son. He needs me. Like, I know God loves my son, but he needs me, Mum. Like, no one's going to love my son like I'm going to love him. No one's going to care for him like I'm going to care for him. Yes, I've got brothers, and yes, they will love him, but they can't love him like I love him. They're not going to be able to give him what I want to give him, Mum, you know?" And my mum was heartbroken, you know what I mean? And she knew exactly what I was talking about, but that was my whole thing. Like, I'm going to fight as hard as I can because I'm not going to deprive my son of anything that he needs in his life. And that's not to say that God loves my son more than I do. I know that. But I didn't want to rob my son of the ability to go to school and to tell his friends that, you know, my dad's around, my dad's a coolest guy, my dad does this for me, my dad does that. Instead, he's going to go to school and tell his friends that, "Oh, my dad died from cancer when I was 3 years old." I was like, I can't let that happen. Like, I got to do everything in my power. And it's not up to me whether I survive or die. That's up to God. But I got to do everything in my power to fight this cancer as hard as I can. And that's what I did. You know what? It was an invisible opponent. Cancer was an invisible opponent, but I was determined to knock it out. I was determined. I was like, no matter what I go through, no matter how much pain I feel, no matter how much crying I do, no matter how much vomiting I do, I'm not going to give up, because I'm not going to give up without a fight. I want my son to know that regardless of what happens to me, that Dad never gave up without a fight. And I would always tell him every day, "Dad," I ring him on the phone and say, "Dad, I just need to tell you something. I'm fighting really hard, Dad, and I love you, Dad. I'm going to fight my ass off, Dad, and I'm not leaving you." You know, and when your son's 3 years old and he's got the ability to tell you, "Dad, are you going to die?" He said, "Hell no, Dad. I'm not. Dad, the only way I'm going to die is if God calls me, Dad. But I'm going to fight, Dad. I'm going to be there for you, Dad. I promise you, Dad." And that was my whole thing. That was my driving force through the whole thing. You see, when you get sick, or when something happens to you, calamity hits you, if it's just about you, you might just give up because it's just about you. It's like getting old. People get old, right? And they get to a certain age, you know, their friends have died. Maybe their wife has died. Maybe their husband has died. Maybe their kids have died. They start to just give up. You know what I mean? They just give up. But I had something to fight for, and I had something to live for, and it wasn't just for me. It was something for far greater than just me. It was important for me to be there for my wife and my son. So I wasn't going to give up, Tris.
Have you remained optimistic, even through the worst bouts of chemo and everything else? Or were there times where you were thinking, like, I can't do this anymore?
I'm not going to lie to you that there was 4 or 5 or 6 occasions where that happened, where I was like, "God, please, you know, I can't take the pain anymore. Please, God, I'm calling upon you right now, God. Take me, but please look after my wife and son." Because I was in so much pain, Tris, but God had other plans, man. God was like, "I'm not ready for you yet. You know what I mean? There's a bigger journey for you. And I really believe that, you know, I mean this, that the best is yet to come for me. You know what I mean? Like what I think God has written for me and what's going to come out of this journey is like going to be something that's going to inspire many, many people, man.
How did you feel about the hair loss and the change of you physically?
I was, you know, when I lost my hair and I lost my beard and all that stuff, you know, I was, I'm not going to say that I wasn't like her. I was like, because people like, you know, people, I don't think people mean it, but they look at you a bit different, you know, when you've lost your hair and your beard, and people know me to look a certain way. So I'd be at a certain place and people would be like, what happened? Are you Billy Dib? What happened? And I'm like, oh man, I got cancer. And they're like, I must be living under a rock. I didn't hear anything about it. So yeah, look, it's okay. You know what I mean? It's okay. And I'm always accepting. So I'm always like, listen, man, everything that happens from God is okay. You know what I mean? I accept God's decree for me. So I don't complain. I just say, thank you, God. You know what I mean? Chris, I never ever said to God, why me? Never. I just said, God, please, you know, if you can hear me right now, I'm asking you to help me, please. I'm just begging upon you. I'm begging and I'm calling upon you, please. Help me, please.
Because people obviously will know about, you know, your struggles in the more recent past, but you were actually born fighting, weren't you? Back in 85.
I was.
When you were suffering, yeah. You suffered with asthma and spent, is this right, 6 months in an incubator?
Yeah, close to that, man. I was in and out of hospital and just, you know, not in a good way, you know what I mean? I wasn't in a good way, and you know, I fought hard as a kid, you know what I mean? So maybe it was something that was instilled in me to just be a fighter. But I've definitely had my fair share of ups and downs in my life and that. But I'm just, like I said to you, I'm just so grateful that I'm still around and I could be there for my son and my wife. I'm grateful, man. And who knows what's to come, Tris? You know what I mean? Like, you know, people keep asking me, are you gonna fight again, or what are you gonna do? And I don't know what I'm gonna do. All I know is that I'm here for a far greater purpose than just boxing. You know what I mean? There's a lot of great things that will come from this. You know what I mean? And I feel like I'm going to be one of those people who's going to inspire many people to overcome their adversities and their hardships and their setbacks.
Wow, I wasn't even going to go there. But is fighting again, like, that's in your mind to an extent, possibly doing something? Look,
man, the thing is, I love fighting. You know, I really, really do. And, you know, I'm sure that a lot of fighters love to fight. You know what I mean? But, you know, when like, you know, when they said the candle's burning on both ends, you know, like, how much more can you push before you get injured? You know what I mean? So, like, you know, the thing is for me, you know, maybe an exhibition bout or maybe like a farewell bout or something like that. Maybe. You know what I mean? But at this stage, I'm not even thinking about that. All I'm thinking about right now is how grateful I am to be there for my wife and my son and just to be able to spend time with my family. That's what I'm so grateful about. You know what I mean? I'm not trying to be out there trying to attain things, buy things, or I'm not doing any of that. I'm just so grateful to be around and just have time.
So obviously your brother boxed the other day and we were swapping some messages. Does that mean that you were watching him and getting the itch a little bit and thinking, you know, there's still, you know, possibly I could still do this again?
Look, the thing is that I boxed in March of last year, you know, and the plan was to fight Jacob NG, beat Jacob NG, and go on to maybe fight against, you know, George Kambosos or somebody in the lightweight division. You know what I mean? We even talked to Jorge Linares people. You know, there was a few fights being tossed up, and to be quite honest with you, I was more or less looking for a big fight that was going to pay me the right money, the money that I deserved, to be able to, you know, sail off into the sunset, obviously with a win, you know, because everyone wants to go out a winner. But you know, God had other plans, you know what I mean? I got cancer and, you know, I was in a fight of my life. So, you know, now that I'm on the mend and getting better, you know, my goals have sort of changed, you know what I mean? Like my plans have changed. But I'm sure that if an offer was made and it was, a handsome offer, then I would definitely consider it, because at the end of the day, for me, it's all about looking after my family, you know what I mean? You know, a little bit more money is not going to hurt, you know what I mean? But if I never boxed again, then I wouldn't be upset. I'd be all right with it because I get to watch, you know, my brother blossom. I've got another kid that I'm looking after. His name's Munir Fateh. He's an amazing, amazing fighter. And I can guarantee that with my guidance, the kid will become champion of the world. You know what I mean? So, like, there's definitely special things out there for me. I'm not hell-bent on fighting again. At the end of the day, like I said to you, if I get a handsome offer, then I might consider it. But if I don't, then I'll just sail off into the sunset. It's fine.
Your positive outlook and strong sort of family ties, has that come from your parents?
Yeah, I mean, look, my father raised us. You know, I had five brothers and one sister. We were raised to really look out for each other and always be tight. And, you know, one of us falls, the all of us are down there with him. You know what I mean? One of us is up there, then the others, we're all together. When one's succeeding, we all succeed. When one fails, we all fail with them. You know what I mean? We're all there to look after each other. And so that's something that my father instilled in us, and it's something that we've carried on. Like, even for me, you know, being sick in the hematology ward, you know, there's 7 days in the week. And, you know, I've got five brothers and one sister. So my brothers would have a roster where they'd come, like, one day this brother would come, this day the brother would come, then my sister would come. Then on every Saturday, my wife would come, you know what I mean? So, like, the roster was very full. And then every night, without fail, my mum would stay with me. My mum had this rule that no one was allowed to stay with me except for her. And so, you know, I respected that. She was like, I want to be there at night. I have to be there. Please don't allow anyone to take my shift. And I was like, don't worry, mum, you'll be there, you know? So, like, we come from a very close family. And like I said to you, and I had reasons to fight, and I fought as hard as I could to be there for them.
And your parents were greengrocers, right? And did you nearly go down that route?
No, I never went down that route. But my father, my father was actually a very, very intelligent man. And if my memory serves me correctly, he was studying accounting. And then unfortunately his father passed away, and my father had to basically fend for his family and our family, you know what I mean? So, like, you know, my father found a store, a greengrocer store, and you know, that was his way of basically teaching us customer service, you know, how we talk to people, how we do. And I think that's something that really helped me as a young kid, you know what I mean? Like, I had such good manners. Like, my father taught us such good manners, you know, how to greet people. Good afternoon, sir. Good evening, ma'am. You know, all this stuff. And, like, he taught us such good, you know, how can I say it?
People skills.
People skills and customer service. That's what he wanted us to learn, you know. But it taught us discipline as well. It taught us discipline, you know what I mean? And we worked hard for everything that we had. We saw how hard Dad worked to you know, to feed the family. And we appreciated everything that my father ever gave us. We were very respectful and hardworking kids.
So what took you to the gym in the first place? And I believe you were 12 years old. Does a kid with, you know, strong family ties and all the rest of it wind up going to a boxing gym?
Well, at the time, when I was 12 years of age, I was at school and I was getting bullied every day. I was getting bullied on a regular basis. The area that we grew up was predominantly Anglo-white. And here we are, brown skin, brown hair, or black hair, brown eyes, you know what I mean? And we were getting picked on a daily basis, going home, you dirty wogs. People would spit at us, throw things at us, you know what I mean? So, like, you know, we were always on the end of the stick where we were getting bullied. And in the end, my father was like, listen, I'm going to put you guys in some after-school sports. And, you know, we just got to kill the kids with kindness, you know what I mean? Don't fight back. My dad didn't want us to fight back and didn't want us to get into fights. He wanted us to get a good education and just do the best that we could. And so, you know, one day at the football field, you know, the trainer pulled out some pads and some gloves, and I threw some punches, and he was very impressed, and he said that I should go to the boxing gym in Sutherland, PCYC. I walked into the gym and never looked back, you know what I mean? I saw my whole future flash in front of my eyes, you know what I mean? At the age of 14, I discovered Prince Nassim Ahmed, who became one of my childhood heroes, and, you know, I just followed his suit, you know what I mean? I followed in his footsteps. He was the IBF featherweight champion in 1997 after knocking out Tom Bull Boom Johnson, and I followed in his footsteps and won it in 2011.
So I was talking to someone the other day actually about bullying, and that stuff stays with you, doesn't it? Like it really has an impact on you at the time, doesn't it?
It definitely does, man. You know, like I had a fear of going to school. I had a definite fear of going to school. I didn't want to go to school. You know, I always looked for an excuse to get out of school. But my father was a very, very wise man, and he's still a very wise man. And he used to tell us, listen, we're going to kill him with kindness. You know, you guys be kind to them, they'll eventually come around, you know. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, my dad just, we took his advice, and you know what? Now I can tell you that the guys that bullied me became some of my closest friends, you know what I mean? And you know, I'll tell you a really funny story, Tris. One of the guys that was a really big bully at my school, you know, he contacted me, I think it was like in 2019, and said, man, I really need to speak to you, you know? And I was like, oh, are you okay? And he's like, I really just, can I take you out for lunch? And I was like, nah, man, it's all good. Is everything okay? He's like, no, I really want to take you out for lunch, please. And I was like, I can't do lunch. I could do dinner. And he's like, man, I'll be there, you know? He goes, send me a location. He come have dinner. And he basically come and sat down with me. He's like, look, man, I really need to apologize to you for everything that I put you through at school. And I was like, man, that's years gone. Don't worry about it. That's so far behind me. I'm not even thinking about it. And he goes, no, I need to explain something to you. So what is it? He goes, I'm getting bullied at work, man. I've been getting bullied at work, and I've got some things going on at work, and some people are really just making my life difficult, man. And all I can keep thinking about is that this is my karma for everything I did to you at school. And I was like, look, man, I forgive you, brother. Don't even stress it, man. I really forgive you. And you know what? He and I are really close friends today, man. We're like actually super close. Wow. So, you know, it shows you how you can turn people around, man. It just, you don't have to fight people. You don't have to fall into their traps. You know what I mean? You just be the bigger man and walk away.
So I was going to say, did you look up to sports stars? Did you look up to other sports stars away from fighters, or was it all about Naz?
No. Growing up as a kid, man, my childhood heroes were Shaquille O'Neal, who played for the Orlando Magic, Penny Hardaway, who also played for the Orlando Magic. You know, I Muhammad Ali was definitely a hero of mine in the boxing world. And then at the age of 14, when I discovered Prince Nassim Ahmed, I was like flabbergasted. You know what I mean? I couldn't believe how good he was and how flamboyant he was. And I was just so excited to just, you know, watch him and copy him and emulate him. And then when I met him when I was 17 years of age, I was like words can't express how I felt, you know what I mean? Like just to be 17 years of age and meet your childhood hero. And Nas went above and beyond for me, you know, the way that he treated me like I was one of his brothers or a son, you could even say, you know, like, so I was, what Nas did for me, people will never understand, man. Like, you're talking about a guy who didn't have to do what he did, but I'd get off the plane and, you know, and I'd have money with me, and he'd be like, don't worry about your money, keep that in your pocket, you're my responsibility right now, while you're in my country, you're my responsibility, you know, and he would spend money on me, take me out for dinners, lunches, you know, let me stay in his home, and never asked me for a dime, man, never. You know, I mean, he was just an amazing guy.
So early on in your amateur career, were you trying to box like Naz? Is that what you were trying to do, or was your coach more fundamental and trying to keep you, on the straight and narrow?
My trainer, I'll tell you exactly what my trainer did. When I was 14 years of age, my trainer, he purchased the video called License to Thrill. I don't know if you've ever seen that. He handed me the cassette video and he said to me, I want you to watch this guy every single day, and this is who I want you to emulate. So 365 days a year, I would watch that video every single day for the next, 14, 15, 16. Then Nas's Greatest Hits came out. So I bought that, you know what I mean? But I would watch his videos all the time, and I'd emulate him. So then when I was 17 years of age and I finally sent him, you know, a cassette video with some of my highlights, he was like, how is there a kid in Australia that fights just like me? Like, nah, you're my hero, man. Like, I want to be just like you. The only thing that was different between me and Nas is Nas had that checkmate power, you know what I mean? I wasn't blessed with that checkmate power, you know? I was a bit taller than him. I was more wiry, you know? But Nas had that power where he could just clock you and put you to sleep. He could be behind 11 rounds and put you to sleep in the 12th round and be like, you know, there you go. But But I didn't have that, you know what I mean? So I had to have a bit more fundamental skills, which is you know, something that Nas would always applaud me for. Like, he was so happy with the jab. Like, my jab was always on point. He's like, man, I love your jab. It's just always bam, bam. You know what I mean? Like, we'd always often talk, you know what I mean? But Nas was always so supportive. Even like last night, I was on the phone with him, right? And I was talking to him and his son, Sammy. Sol, Suleiman. Suleiman's like one of his youngest sons, and he's getting ready to fight as an amateur. And Nas was telling him on the phone, if anybody's going to help you with your fundamentals, it's Billy Dib, you know what I mean? So I was like, well, you know, coming from the Prince, man, that's a big compliment, you know?
So if Nas used to call them rocket launchers, didn't he? So if he had rocket launchers, what did you have?
I had good speed. I had decent power. You know, I was very elusive, that's for sure. I could see the punches coming just like he could. You know what I mean? But I was more of like a spoiler, you could say. You know what I mean? I would just like walk people onto shots. I would spoil them. I would put them under pressure sometimes. But look, man, like I said, you know, I had a great career. Nas had an amazing career. You know, Nas had a career that people would die for. You know what I mean? But I was just grateful that God gave me the opportunity to win two world titles. You know, two world titles that my childhood hero won, which was the IBF and the IBO world titles.
So you had, I believe, 113 amateur fights, and you were close to going to the Athens Games of 2004, but you had a motorcycle crash.
So I had 113 amateur fights. I had 98 wins and 15 losses. And at the age of 17, I was pretty much a, you know, red-hot favorite to go to the Olympic Games to represent Australia. And then just due to a silly mistake of myself, I decided to jump on a motorbike, and I had a motorbike accident and basically, you know, pissed away my Olympic dream. But everything happens for a reason, man. If it wasn't for that motorbike accident, I would have never met Prince Nassim. So, you know, God does things for a reason. And, you know, if you had to ask me, you know, would you rather go to the Olympic Games or would you rather meet Prince Nassim at that age, I would have said to you, I want to meet Prince Nassim. You know what I mean? Like, he was my childhood hero. And I always had this thing about wanting to become champion of the world, you know what I mean? So, like, for me, the Olympic Games would have been cool, but, you know, it was such a – the competition in the amateurs was so difficult, you know what I mean? It was never easy, as you know, like, you're up against Cuba, Russia, Kazakhstan, Hungary, you know, and being coming from Australia, you know, to win a medal was – you were going to be really up against it. So, you know, for me, it was like, if I had the opportunity to meet Prince Nassim or go to the Olympic Games at that time, I would have told you I would have gone for the opportunity to meet Prince Nassim.
And then the authorities from Lebanon reached out to you anyway, didn't they? And said, you know, can you do it for us? Can you go to Athens for us, right?
Yeah, they gave me an opportunity to fight in the Pan African Games and for the opportunity to represent Lebanon at the Olympic Games. And my father was so patriotic about representing Australia. He was like, absolutely not. He goes, my father's exact words to me was, Lebanon did nothing for us. There's no way I'm letting you represent Lebanon. You know what I mean? He goes, if you represent Lebanon, so he gave me a scenario. He goes, you represent Lebanon, and then you get matched up against Australia in the first round, and you beat Australia. Do you think you can ever come back to Australia with your head raised high? Never. He goes, so you can forget that idea. He goes, no one told you to get on a motorbike. You made that mistake. You live with it. And I was like, man, my dad's a hard man, you know?
So, you know, that motorbike crash, were you quite badly messed up physically?
Yeah, I was not in a good way, man. I tore all the skin off my arm. You can still see the scarring, to be honest. If you look at the scarring, yeah. I tore all the skin off here, all top of my arm, my legs, my shoulders. I was wearing a singlet and shorts, and I fell off an R6. So, you know, I wasn't in a good way, man.
So tell me about this. So then you go to Sheffield. So you wind up on the other side of the world. How did that happen? Who pays for it? And how do you reach out to Nas? You obviously said you sent him a VHS tape.
I didn't do that. I mean, my sister came home one day. But the truth is that my lawyer today and one of my closest friends, Adam Huda, he asked me at the time, you know, what my plans were. And I said, oh, I'm going to give it up. You know, and he's like, isn't Prince Nassim one of, like, don't you love Prince Nassim? I was like, yeah. And he says, if I could get you to meet the prince, would you like to go meet the prince? And I was like, I'd love to. And he's like, would your dad let you go? And I was like, of course, man. I've represented Australia all over the world. My dad, he'd never say no, you know? So, and then he was like, all right, I'm going to make it happen. And he goes, I know a connection that knows him really well, so I'm going to make it happen for you. Well, a few days later, I come home, and my sister had a pamphlet that said that Prince Nassim Hamed was going to be a guest speaker at the Kemba Mosque. And I was like, this is unbelievable. Like, this can't be true. And so I made my way to the Kemba Mosque, and there was a sheikh there by the name of Khalid Yassin, who was close friends with Prince Nassim Hamed, and he pretty much said that Prince Nassim was going to be a guest speaker via satellite. And I was like, oh, what a bummer, man. I actually thought Nas was going to be there in person, but he was speaking via satellite. And so I, after the talk was over, I waited till everyone like left, and I followed the sheikh, and I said to him, sheikh, I need to tell you something. Prince Nassim Hamed's my childhood hero. I've emulated my whole career and the way that I fight based on his style. I said, is there any way that you could call him back? I'd love to talk to him. And he said, no, I can't do that. You know, like I don't have the authority to just call him when I want. You know, he's a busy guy and stuff. And I was like, please, Sheikh, like you could do that, man. For the sake of God, you're going to do that for me. And he's like, look, you know, I know a little something about boxing. Why don't I come watch you train tomorrow, and then I'll make a decision on what I can do to help you. But the next day, the Sheikh came to watch me train, and he was really, really impressed. And he was like, man, Prince Nassim's going to love you. And I'm like, well, can you ring him? He's like, I can't call him. He goes, but I'll tell you what. He goes, I'm going to send you to this company called One Path Network. They're going to put some of your fights on a cassette video. They're going to do a little portfolio for you, and they'll give it to me, and I'll give it to Prince Nassim. And I was like, come on, man. Please, Sheikh, I'm begging you, you know. And so he actually did come through, you know. I mean, I got the portfolio together, and I gave him the cassette video. And a week later, I got a call from Prince Nassim Hamed. And, you know, a couple of days later, I was on a plane, and it was all looked after by Nas. You know, I mean, Nas paid for everything and sorted the whole thing out. You know, my brothers gave me some spending money, you know, Nas welcomed me with open arms.
So where did you train when you were here in England? Because I'm guessing you didn't train at the Ingle Gym, did you?
Well, actually, what happened was when I arrived into UK, I was staying with Khalid Yassin for a few days because he was living in the UK at the time. And I started to feel like this whole thing from Nas was like a setup. Like I wasn't going to meet him because he sort of kept me on ice for 3 days. I was waiting around for him for 3 days and never got to see him. And I was like sort of like a little bit disheartened, to be quite honest. And then I asked the sheikh if he could take me to the gym. And he took me to a gym in Sheffield, which was the Ingle Gym. And when I got there, there was Johnny Nelson was in the gym. Kell Brook was in the gym. You know, Brendan Ingle was in the gym. Dominic Ingle was in the gym. So I just wrapped up and started doing a bit of a training session with them. I did a bit of sparring with Brendan, with Johnny Nelson. You know, Johnny was obviously taking it easy on me, but it was just body sparring, you know. Had a little bit of fun. And then next thing you know, the driver walks in and he goes, oh, we got to go. And I'm like, I'm not done with training yet, man. And he's like, we got to go. I got to take you somewhere. And I was like, where? And he's like, I'll talk to you outside in the car, you know. So I just packed up and Johnny said to me, I'm more than welcome to come back the next day if I want. Well, that driver drove me to Prince Nassim Hamed's gym, which was in Sheffield as well. It was a private gymnasium, and I walked in there, and, you know, there was Nas, you know, standing right next to the boxing bag waiting for me. And I was, when I saw him, I just broke down into tears, you know, and I just started crying. I couldn't believe that it was him. And he walked over, gave me a big hug, and he asked me where my gear was. And I was like, it's in the car. He's like, well, get it because you're staying with me, you know. And I basically spent the next couple of weeks staying with Nas, which was just an absolute dream come true, man.
So apparently Nas told you to turn pro, but you didn't stay in England. You went back to Australia to turn pro there. How come you went back to Australia and you didn't stay in England?
Well, my trainer was living in Australia. And to be honest, when I started to hang out with Nas was like, let's call your trainer. Let's get him over here. Let's get him to come over here. And, you know, I want to assess both you guys and, you know, give you guys some advice. So I rang my trainer, Harry, at the time, and he made his way over to England, and we spent some time together, and it was unreal, you know. And he gave us some advice, and you know, basically what I did was I went home, turned pro. I had five fights, and after my fifth pro fight, I went back and spent some time with Nas, which was amazing. And you know, I'd do that. I'd just have a few fights, and I'd go back and hang out with Nas, get more information, get more advice, and get more training in with him. Did loads and loads of body sparring. You know, I'd always pick his brain. And then when I was 13-0, Nas was incarcerated for a car accident when he smashed his SLR and injured somebody in an accident. And so once once that happened, I went to America and I was with Jeff Fenwick, and that's when I met Shane Mosley and Oscar De La Hoya and Bernard Hopkins, and basically signed on with the Golden Boy Promotions, and that's when my career with Golden Boy started.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask about Jeff. So how did you hook up with Jeff? Because obviously, you know, when you talk about Naz and Jeff Fenwick, you're apples and oranges in terms of fighting styles, aren't you? And mindsets.
Yeah, no doubt. But the thing was, Jeff Fenwick was an iconic legend, you know, and he's an iconic legend in Australian boxing. And so, you know, when I was a kid growing up, people take notice, you know, and Jeff was one of them guys that took notice. And he always was there to help, to lend a helping hand. And he always gave me good advice. And, when I was 21 years of age, Jeff invited me to spend some time with him in Vegas to train with Mike Tyson. You know, I was absolutely, you know, just, you know, wrapped. I couldn't believe it. You know, the invitation was, you know, something that I wasn't expecting, and it was an unbelievable birthday gift. And made my way over to the UK, to the US with Jeff, and spent some time training with him, and then ran into this guy who knew Prince Nassim Hamed in Vegas, and pretty much, you know, just got on the phone with Naz while I was over there, and this guy asked Naz a few questions about me, and Naz clarified everything, and then the guy said to me, I'm very good friends with Sugar Shane Mosley and Bernard. He goes, are you signed to anybody? I go, no, I'm 13 and up, but I'm a free agent, you know. I've just been doing it off, you know, fighting on Fenwick Fight Nights and stuff like that on TV, on Fox Television at home. Mate, he pretty much just lined me up with Shane Mosley, and that was the beginning of the journey with Sugar Shane Mosley and Golden Boy Promotions.
By the way, with Jeff, were you training with Skinny and Hussey, the Hussein boys? Were you training with those guys, or did you come a little bit after them?
No, I came. So they were around. They were still pro when I first turned pro. They were still pro, and they were competing. But I wasn't on their team. But I did know them very well. You know, I mean, they were a part of my childhood, and you know, I spent plenty of time with them. But it wasn't until later in my career that they became very involved in my career when I started training with Billy Hussein.
So you won your first nine in Australia, but then boxed in Sheffield. You boxed on the Hatton Mauser bill, didn't you?
I did. On the undercard of Carlos Mauser versus Ricky Hatton. I was supposed to fight a guy on the undercard, and he didn't turn up to the weigh-in. And so then last minute, they brought in this guy who was fighting at welterweight. And I mean, I was a featherweight, super featherweight, and you know, I basically, you know, weighed in with my clothes on and everything like that. And I fought this guy who was a journeyman. His name was Emad Karmas. It was a nasty fight because he was a southpaw, pretty ugly style, and you know, I just had to grind to get the win. You know what I mean? But it was a good experience, and you know, basically put me at 10-0 after that.
By the way, you had a DQ win over Hazar Ankajas. What happened with that? The DQ win.
Well, he was being extremely dirty in the fight, and then the fight sort of broke out into a little bit of a brawl, and then he tripped me over when I was getting up off the floor. He punched me while I was on the floor, so the referee DQ'd him.
So you had mentioned obviously going to the States. So you fought on the Winky Wright Ike Quarty bill in Tampa for your US debut against Philip Payne. A big bill on HBO, and obviously, like you said, you made connections, became a sparring partner to Shane Mosley. So how was it working with Shane?
Incredible, man. Sugar Shane Mosley today is still one of my close friends, and somebody who I held dear to my heart. Sugar Shane was an amazing, amazing champion, and an even better human, you know, just a beautiful human. And as well, you know, Sugar Shane Mosley invited me to his home. I lived in his home with him and his wife and kids, and unbelievable, you know, just to experience these things.
I was going to say, you there's got to be a lot of pinch me moments here where you're talking about Mosley, you're talking about Tyson, you're talking about Naz, you know, for a kid with big dreams from, you know, son of a greengrocer's in Australia. It's a great story, isn't it? Great story. So you fought on Shane's bill when he fought Louis Collazo in Vegas. Then you fought on the bill against Cotto in the Garden. You actually botched Rogers Mataagua, who was obviously in a fight of the year a couple of years after that, wasn't he, against Juan Manuel Lopez. What was Mataagua like?
He was easy. He was a cool fight, man, but I schooled him. You know, I mean, I won every round. He couldn't hit me to save his life. And I mean, I was too elusive and too clever for him. But you know, he after me, he fought Gamboa, he fought Juan Marquez, Lopez. So you know, like, he was a proven guy, you know what I mean? But when he fought me, like, if you look at the scorecard, I was shutting down every single round. He couldn't touch me. I drove him crazy, man. And he was so frustrated, and I just walked him onto shots, and I made a fun night of it.
And in terms of big occasions, it didn't get much bigger than the Mayweather-De La Hoya bill in Vegas, where you fought Jose Alberto Gonzalez. Like, that's it's as good as it gets, isn't it? Right, by being on bills like that.
Unbelievable, man! What an absolute buzz that was. You know, what I mean, to be a part of that promotion, part of that undercard was phenomenal, man. And not just that, I was in training camp with De La Hoya in Puerto Rico, so we trained in Bayamón, Puerto Rico. You know, I was hanging out with people like Ivan Calderon and like all these great champions. I was having mad fun, man. And I had some unbelievable sparring when I was out there. You know, at the time, Oscar had signed some really good Filipino fighters. And, you know, I was basically getting amazing sparring. I even worked with Francisco Panchito Bajardo, who was an Olympian at the age of 17 and like had, you know, big raps on him until Jesse James Leal beat him. So I was a part of a really, really good camp, you know, and I had an amazing time. And you know what? All of these stories have been revealed in my autobiography that's now available at billydib.com.au, and you can pre-purchase it. And if you buy it, I'll be sending it out to you the following week. So, you know, it's an amazing story, an amazing book, and I've revealed all these amazing stories with it.
Yeah, I'll get to the book, definitely, because I've seen that Mike Altamura has been putting it out there on social media as well. Going back, by the way, I was looking through the archives of your reports, and a lot of them are similar, right? So a lot of your fight reports are similar. Flashy, good left hand, switch hitter, not a heavy puncher. Did you ever think power was a problem, and was it something that you tried to work on?
It was never a problem, man, because I could knock people out. I had no problem knocking people out. You know what I mean? Like, the thing is, I was a good body puncher. So, you know, when you're snatching the body, sometimes people, they can take it to the head, but then you hit them in the body. And when you're snatching that body for a long time, eventually they just break down. You know what I mean? So, like, on my journey to winning the IBF world title, I think I had 8 stoppage wins in the 10 fights leading up to that. So, like, you know, I could punch. It's not that I couldn't punch. And, like, I was a devastating body puncher. You know, if I hit you in the body, you'd stay hit. You know what I mean? So, like, but the thing is, times I would opt to just box because I was like, you know what, I'm not going to get hit today. So I just box and drive the guy crazy. You know what I mean? Pepper him, win the fight and just get it on points. You know what I mean? Like, there was times that I wanted to prove a point that I could just make somebody look stupid for 12 rounds. And that's what I'd do.
So, you boxed on another big bill. These Golden Boy shows are great, by the way, obviously. And you boxed on Casimir Katsidis, which is a great fight in its own right. Were you and Katsidis pals from Australia?
I didn't really know Michael Katsidis, but I knew of him because of him being Australian and stuff. So obviously when we connected in Cabazon, California, you know, we definitely hung out and chatted and everything like that. We supported him. He supported us. But I wasn't like we grew up in different states, you know what I mean? He grew up in Queensland. I grew up in Sydney, Australia. You know what I mean? So like we lived in different states, but I supported him. He supported me. You know what I mean?
How's he doing these days? And are you in touch with him at all?
You know, Michael's cool, man. I'm not in touch with him, but we've shared a few messages over the past. I know he's doing okay. You know what I mean? He's really looking after himself. And you know, he's obviously had a little bit of a hard life, but Michael's a very resilient guy, and you know, I'm just proud of him, man. He's still living his life, man, which is important.
You won a split decision over Vargas on that bill, but went back to Australia. And then you started training with Johnny Lewis, who's obviously the Australian Hall of Famer. What was Johnny like? Who was like the go-to guy in Australia, wasn't he?
Yeah. When I was given a split decision against Vargas, we were as shocked as you saying that. I schooled him. Like, if I send you the fight, you'd be lucky to score him one round. I thought that I won every single round, you know what I mean? Like, I absolutely schooled him. But it was in Cabazon. He was from Cabazon. The referee was from Cabazon. It was one of those fights, you know what I mean? Like, I was up against that. I was up against him, the judges, the crowd. but they just couldn't rob me of it. You know what I mean? Like, it was like when they scored split decision, we were all looking at each other like, what the heck? Are you kidding me? Like, Sugar Shane Mosley was shocked. He was like, shocked. How's that a split decision? Like, what the hell does a kid got to do to get a proper decision here, you know? But when I went after that fight, I made my way home and I linked up with Johnny Lewis. And, you know, then I had two stoppage wins, you know, back to back, and they were against like mediocre opposition. And then I fought Zelani Morali for the IBO world title, which was an absolute cracker of a fight. You know what I mean? It was a back and forth battle. And, you know, in the end, I was declared the winner by unanimous decision, but it was a very, very difficult fight.
Yeah. So it's fair to say that not everyone had you winning that one.
The Morali fight?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it was three neutral judges and each one of them scored it for me. I was confident that I had won. Johnny Lewis was confident that I had won. I mean, it was just that the commentary was like a little bit funny. I remember the commentary was done by Paul Briggs and another guy by TK. And, you know, like it was like, you at the start they're giving it to me, then they're giving it to him, then they're giving it to me, and so you get it, you're a bit confused when you're watching it. But when you turn off the volume and you watch it, you got Billy Dibs on that fight, you know what I mean? Because I was like a little bit upset because the IBO eventually, you know, from all the reviews I was getting, eventually called for a rematch, and I was like, I don't need a rematch, I'm just gonna move on with my career. You know, if I've beaten you once, I'll beat you again, so I'm just gonna move on. There's no point, I'm not getting paid extra money to fight you again.
Then you were back on HBO Atlantic City on another big bill, Hopkins Pavlik, and it was against the very good Steve Luovano, who was a really useful fighter, wasn't he?
Even though, no, man, he was very clever, and he had beaten Nicky Cook from the UK to win the WBO world title. It was a very slick southpaw, and it was a stinker of a fight. It was like an absolute stinker, man. It was like it was one of them fights that you just definitely don't fancy. You know what I mean? Like, he was very, very, just cautious in his approach. He wouldn't engage. You know, it made the fight very, very difficult. You know, I think he was just happy to walk away with a decision win. It wasn't like he won by a wide decision. It was a close fight, but I just felt like I could have done a lot more that night to try to win it. But he was just being very cagey. You know, it's very, very hard. When you're fighting somebody who's fighting very cagey, it's very hard to drag him into a fight. And, man, he was just like just a boring southpaw, you know what I mean? But it worked for him, you know what I mean? And Steven's a pretty cool guy, you know what I mean? He reached out to me when I got sick and stuff like that. So, you know, I got a lot of respect for Steven Logan, that man.
I actually covered his fight with Nicky Cook in London back in the day. I think that was on the same bill as Amir Khan and Willie Limond, if I remember rightly. You go back to Australia then after Luovano, and it looks like some sort of exile. Five fights, 15 fights back home, including winning the IBF title against Jorge Lacerda in Homebush. How big a night was that for you? Was that as good as it got?
That was the defining moment of my career. You know what I mean? It was like the IBF world title was special, but this was like super special, man. The IBF world title, to be recognized as, you know, one of the best fighters in the world, the legitimate world championship, you know, the IBF world title was so legitimate. You know, great champions in the past had held it. And to finally be recognized as a legitimate champion and then go on to make several defenses was just was an absolute dream come true. You know, I mean, what a journey it was.
Were you getting offers from America in this time, or were you fixed in Australia? Were you trying to build the brand?
No, I was getting offers, you know what I mean? We even were contacted by Golden Boy Promotions, who offered me to fight Gary Russell Jr. And I actually accepted the fight, and then he rejected it, man. So, you know, like Golden Boy tried to get him to fight me, and he didn't want to do it. So, you know, I was getting offers to fight in America, and I guess for me it was just about taking the right offer.
So that offer comes really when you hook up with 50 Cent. As you do in boxing, and he and Lou DiBella have you back with Evgeny Gradovich. I mean, the 50 Cent thing—it's another surreal chapter in the life and times of Billy Dib, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit of a debacle, to be honest with you, man. Because, you know, I when I signed with 50 Cent, I never really signed with 50 Cent. I signed with TMT Promotions. And then him and Floyd Mabber had a fallout. And, you know, when they fell out, I ended up with 50, you know, which is a bit of a, you know, a bummer at the time because I was, like, really excited to work with Floyd. But in the end, I was stuck with 50. And, you know, once I made the decision that I couldn't get out of this contract with 50, Floyd Mabber basically had me blacklisted, you know what I mean? So then HBO wouldn't work with me. Showtime wouldn't work with me. And I couldn't get on a decent card, you know. I mean, I was supposed to be fighting Jason Velez on the undercard of Miguel Cotto versus Austin Trout. And then Floyd Mabber basically, you know, had me blacklisted and I couldn't get the opportunity to fight on that card. And so then you know, 50 was just scrambling trying to get me a fight. And then we had an opponent whose name was Luis Franco. And the fight was pretty much a done deal when I was fighting Larry Spanko. So I prepared for him. Then he pulled out. Then I was fighting a guy called Mauricio Munoz. Then he pulled out. And then last minute, they bring in this guy called Evgeny Gradovich. And, you know, we ended up fighting Gradovich. And it was sort of a short notice or late notice opponent. And I couldn't prepare for him. And you know, I ended up losing a split decision.
So, yeah, he was a tough dude. I was there in Macau when you fought him on the rematch on the Pacquiao brand and real spill.
Yeah. Man, he was 10 times stronger and more developed by the time I fought him on that card. And I was only like not even 7 or 8 months later. But then we found out that he was taking sporting enhancements, you know what I mean? So, like, you know, in the end, he got caught out after fighting Lee Selby that he was actually on some of the good stuff, you know what I mean? And that's what I thought about him when I actually fought him.
By the way, when we talk about divisive characters, and we've mentioned a few, obviously with 50 and Floyd and stuff, you overlapped with Anthony Mundine, who divides opinion. How did you get on with him?
Unbelievable, man. Anthony Mundine was a champion. Great guy, big heart, very giving, very caring. And, you know, and I got to share some really great memories with him, man.
Why has he got a bad rap, then?
I think because he was just outspoken, you know what I mean? Like, not he was outspoken, very confident, very brash. But, like, I don't know why, you know, like, people love him, man. He's loved. You know, we love him. A lot of people love him, you know what I mean? It's just that because he's just an outspoken individual. That's all it is.
In 2015, you were on the road in Japan. You fought Takashi Mura for the WBC. How did that fight go down?
Not good. Not good, man. In the lead up to that fight, I basically broke my rib. I had a broken rib, and I also broke my broken metacarpal in my left hand. You know what I mean? So, like, I was you know, when you say I was sort of hindered, I was definitely hindered. You know what I mean? I was a wounded warrior, but I just felt like there was no way that I could pull out of the fight. You know what I mean? I wasn't his mandatory. It was a voluntary defense, and I just had to take the opportunity. So I got a cortisone in my hand, but unfortunately you can't get a cortisone in your rib cage. And in the end, that was my downfall. You know what I mean? Like, I won the first two rounds against Mira clearly. And then, you know, just trying to protect my rib cage, I got clocked in the face. And I don't know how I got up from the shots that he hit me with, because he hit me while I was going down as well. So on the way down, he hit me with a few more good shots. And I don't know how I got back up, but I got back to my feet. And then the referee asked me to step to him, and I obviously wasn't in a good way and couldn't step to him correctly, and he stopped the fight. He waved it off.
So 2015, though, it was a hard year out of the ring as well, wasn't it? Because you had a girlfriend, Sarah, who became your wife.
She was my wife.
So it was during that period. How hard was that for you? And is it still hard for you to talk about that time now?
And look, it's a part of the journey, you know what I mean? At the end of the day, as I said to you, I'm a very accepting individual, and everything in life happens for a reason. Nothing happens by accident. And I trust in God's decree, and God had decreed for that to be. And I just pray that Sarah is resting in a much better place, you know what I mean? I'm just grateful for the time that I had with her, and just you know, just pray that God has granted her the highest levels in paradise.
Because for anyone who doesn't know, she was only 21. You got married after she was diagnosed with leukemia, and 6 weeks later she was gone, right?
That's correct, yeah.
I mean, I'm not trying to emphasize the points, but that is harrowing. That's a that's it's a lovely love story, but also harrowing at the same time.
At the time, I was devastated, man, and I couldn't work out. I mean, I couldn't work out what God's plan for me was. But God's the best of plans, man. And I just, like I said to you, Chris, I'm not a guy who complains or says why me, or I just accept God's decree, you know, and I'm very, very accepting.
And you were spending nights sleeping on the floor in her hospital room, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it was like I said to you, it was very, very tough. But I just had to be there for her. You know, I had made her a promise that I would be there and I wouldn't give in. And I wouldn't leave her until her dying moments.
Did you nearly not go back to boxing after that?
Yeah, I mean, I made a decision to, you know, I wasn't sure if I wanted to box anymore, and I was gonna walk away from the sport of boxing. But after reading back on some of her messages, I made a decision that it was probably gonna be best for me to just come back to the gym and just try to. Overcome this tragedy that I've gone through.
Did having boxing help, you know, in terms of mindset, yeah, the training and everything else?
Yeah, man, it definitely helped. You know, it was such a help at the time. You know, I mean, boxing was a savior. You know what I mean? Yeah, boxing's been a savior for so many careers. And for me, it was such a savior. And it helped me find myself. You know what I mean? I was lost for a little while, but boxing helped me find myself again.
And then you found yourself in the Barclays Center on another big Bill Garcia Broner. And it's another chapter. This time you're popping up in New York. But it's great stuff, isn't it? It's great to, like, I don't know, you're all these big bills, you know, Pacquiao, Mayweather, your friends with Mosley, you've seen Tyson, you've been hanging out with Naz on and off. Like, it's just a great, and obviously getting a great career in your own right with WBC title fights and winning the IBF title. It's surreal, isn't it? It's a little bit of a fairy tale.
I lived five lives, you know what I mean? It was a dream come true, you know. Everything that I achieved in my career, I was just so happy and blessed, you know what I mean? Like, I just felt so blessed to be able to achieve the things that I achieved and just to walk the road that I walked, because people dream to have that kind of a career. They dream of it.
In 2018, you fight Tevin Farmer, who goes down under to fight you and wins on points. Then you have this crazy fight with Amir Khan, like, but who'd fought obviously up at light middleweight before. How does that come about, you and Amir?
that's just a funny story in itself, man. Amir Khan contacted me and asked me if I'd be interested in fighting on his undercard, and I was gonna fight this guy called Isaac on Amir Khan's undercard, and he was from Indonesia. It was pretty much a done deal. My opponent had arrived into Saudi Arabia, and then a few days prior to me leaving Australia to go to Saudi Arabia, Amir Khan's manager at the time, Bill Desage, makes his way to Australia and, you know, has this meeting with me and talks to me about, you know, how great the show is going to be and all these things. And then, you know, he's asked me a couple of personal questions and how am I doing financially and all this sort of stuff. And then basically goes on to tell me that Amir Khan's opponent has had a motorbike accident, injured himself in a motorbike accident, which is absolute bollocks. It's not true. What happened was is that Saudi Arabia had said that they're not going to allow a Pakistani and an Indian to fight each other. They didn't want that. They didn't want that matchup, you know what I mean? So they made up this thing about Amir Khan's opponent injuring himself in a bike accident. But that worked out to be my fortune, you know what I mean? Because it's highly people know that 50 Cent and I had a little bit of a fallout, and that he robbed me for some money. You know what I mean? I was on a short stick of some money. And you know, basically, what Amir Khan did and what Bill decided is they offered me this opportunity to fight Amir Khan, and I couldn't work out why. But the reason why they offered me the opportunity is because they needed somebody with a visa, and if you didn't have a visa, you weren't able to get into Saudi Arabia at the time. So I had this visa, and I was the most experienced guy on the card, besides Amir Khan, and so they put me in as a replacement to fight Amir Khan, but they paid me a ton of money. You know what I mean? So it was basically like, for me, it was like walking in robbing the bank. You know what I mean? Like, it was like it was an opportunity to earn some great money, look after my family. And, you know, as my trainer said, he goes, no one's going to remember that Amir Khan beat you, you know what I mean? But, you know, he's a big guy, you know what I mean? And you never expected to beat him anyway. So it was just an amazing opportunity.
How good was Amir?
He was all right. He was okay, you know what I mean? I always felt that if I was at the same size as him, that I'd have a much better chance. It was just, there was a David versus Goliath thing, you know what I mean?
There were three more fights for you, one in 2019, one in 2021, and then that final one you referred to in 2022. Why were you getting sporadic towards the end? What was going on? Was that pandemic COVID, and everything else?
COVID did that, man. If it was up to me, I would have fought every month, but COVID did that, you know what I mean? But I wanted to work my way back into another world championship, you know what I mean? But unfortunately, you know, with COVID, that was made to be very, very difficult, and I lost some good years due to COVID. But that's God's plan, man. So, you know, God had better plans for me.
And then obviously, so when did you get the diagnosis? Obviously, that last fight was March 2022, and how did it come about for you to get the diagnosis? Did you start feeling unwell and went to the doctors, or?
I started feeling unwell, man. I had really bad abdomen pain. Was always very tired, and in the end, the pain was so excruciating, man. And I just made my way to the hospital, and that was the beginning of the journey, man. The beginning of the cancer journey, and that started in October, and worked its way all the way through to October, November, December, January, February. And then a little bit of March, man, and then thank God it's over.
So did they diagnose you on the day? Is that how it works? Or do you do a load of tests and then you get results or what?
They did a load of tests that took about 4 or 5 days. And then in the end, they just, they first found colon, that found the tumor in my colon. So they had that removed. It was a 5-centimeter tumor. They cut out a 9-centimeter diameter of what was going on around it. And then a few weeks later, I got sick again, and then they worked out that I had been misdiagnosed and that I actually had non-Hodgkin's Becker lymphoma cancer.
Wow. And then so did they lay out the plans? You're going to have this amount of chemo over this amount of time, yeah. And so you kind of...
They gave us basically a transcript of what was going to happen. You know what I mean? And it was a horrendous journey. You know what I mean? Like the chemo was something that you wouldn't wish upon your worst enemy. I wasn't well. You know what I mean? I wasn't well, and I didn't feel good. And the sleepless nights, the endless vomiting, the nausea. You know what I mean? The just becoming an insomniac, you know what I mean? Like just not feeling well. I'm just glad that it's over. Let's just say that.
So I'm guessing your sleep pattern still hasn't returned, right? Because you're up for doing podcasts at ridiculous times of night, which is getting late for you. Like I'm normally in bed a couple of hours ahead of where you are now. So I'm guessing you've still got some sort of residual habits that have changed from that, like, or have you always just been a night owl?
No, not at all. To be honest with you, this chemotherapy has made me somewhat of an insomniac, you know what I mean? So like I can't get much sleep anymore, and I'm always waking up in the middle of the night and just not feeling the best. But it's slowly working its way out of my system, you know. And my wife is lined me up with a naturopath who's giving me some medication to help me clean my body out, and I'm just grateful, man. It's over and done with now, and now I'm just on the mend.
How's your wife been through it all? Because she's obviously, she must have been through every kind of emotion going.
Yeah, for sure, man. It's not been easy for her either. You know what I mean? And I often would ask her, you know, like, I know I'm going through this physically, mentally, and emotionally, but you must be going through this mentally and emotionally as well, because it's got to take a toll, you know what I mean? So it's very important that when you're going through a journey like this, that you don't forget the people that are around you, because you might be suffering from the disease, but they're also suffering watching you suffer.
Yeah, of course. And now it does sound like, you know, where we were at the start of the conversation, that you are massively inspired to get out and start promoting positivity as much as anything else, right?
That's the plan, man. That's the plan, is to go out there and just shed light and just be a voice for those who don't have a voice. You know what I mean? I just want to be there for people who need it. You know, because at the end of the day, it's all about, you know, giving back where you can. And I've always tried to be that type to give people back. And that's what I want to do. I want to help kids. I want to help adults, whoever I can help, whoever needs help. And I did a post on my social media a few nights ago, and I just said, you know, cancer is a very difficult thing. And if anyone needs any advice, or, you know, they're going through it themselves, just know that I'm a phone call away, and then I'm here if you want to talk.
Yeah, I mean, I did this podcast with Robert Diaz, the matchmaker, recently. And, yeah. You know, his story on cancer was really, really interesting as well. Like, so I'm sure he's reached out to you, right?
He's one of my biggest supporters, man. Me and Robert Diaz have been friends since my Golden Boy days. You know, he's an amazing human being. I love him to death. And, you know, he really, really supported me throughout this journey.
And so with regards to the book, tell us about the book again. So who have you written it with, and have you done it as like a legacy thing? Is this one of the, did you think about, you know, I want to leave it for my son to read my story and that kind of stuff?
Definitely. But this book was written by KMB Books. I wrote the book and they, you know, they had a ghostwriter go over it and clean it up. But the book's written by me. It's all my stories, all my tales. You know, it's the journey of Billy Dib, but it's not a boxing book. It has a lot of boxing stories in it, but this is a book about life, a book about overcoming the hardships of life, overcoming the adversities of life, and just bouncing back and having a never say die attitude. You know what I mean? That's what it's all about. And that's what I want to teach people, is that with a vision, you know what I mean? We all have these visions about wanting to be this successful person and doing this and doing that and whatever. And, you know, but unless you're consistent in your vision, you know what I mean, you'll never see success. But so in life, you know, if you have a vision in life and you're consistent in your approach, the only thing that will follow is success. You know what I mean? And that's the message that I want to give to people, that through hope and through hard work, anything can be achieved.
And I suppose I just wanted to ask one more thing, Billy, if I can. It's just about fear, right? You know, I talk about pre-fight fear with some of the guys on the podcast and nerves and that kind of stuff, but you know, with what you've been through, you must have had a lot of fear in your, well, I suppose in your life, but certainly the last few months. Is it one of those things where you do live in fear about bad news and feeling bad and that kind of stuff?
Look, the truth is, Tris, is that I'm going to be honest with you, my only fear was leaving my wife and my son. That's it. That was my biggest fear. Of like, what am I going to do? What will happen to them if I die? Like, who's going to look after them? You know what I mean? Like, that was my biggest thing. And so, you know, when sometimes you hear about somebody who dies in a horrific car accident, you know what I mean? I often think about that person and I think, I wonder if he got a chance to tell his mother or his father that he loves them. I wonder if he was given the chance to tell his sister or his brother or his wife or his son that he loved them, you know what I mean? Or she loved them. You know what I mean? So then when God gave me this opportunity, like I know I was sick with cancer, but he gave me time, you know, because they said to me, you got 6 months to live. So I figured that what was important is that I had to put things in place. You know, so I made sure to tie my camel, as they say in Islam, they said, tie your camel. The Prophet of Muhammad, the Prophet of Allah, Muhammad, peace and blessing be upon him, our Prophet Muhammad says, tie your camel. That's exactly what I did. I tied my camel and I made sure to put everything in place. You know, like I made sure that if I had any property, I put it in place for my wife and my son. I made sure that my will was up to date. You know, I own a really cool car. I made sure that I gave instructions about the car. You know, I spoke to my oldest brother about, you know, my son's education and things like that. So I really put things in place I was just glad that God gave me time to be able to put things in the place before I die, if I was going to die, you know?
And so now moving forwards, what's the mindset? Has your mindset changed now you've come through this? And does it make you more grateful? Do you appreciate more? Do you like the small things more? Do different things make you happy or content?
You nailed it, man. You just said it correctly right there, man. My mindset has changed because I think I said to you earlier that, you know, before I got sick, I was all about trying to attain things, win things, take things, be given things. You know what I mean? I was all about, like, I'm a very giving person, but I was all about trying to attain as well, you know what I mean? More property, more cars, more this, more that. And then I got sick with cancer, and the only thing that I wanted was more time. So now I value time. Like, I value time so much more now because, as I said to you, sometimes somebody gets taken in a car accident or in a tragic manner, and then they never got the chance to tell their loved ones that they love them. So now I just appreciate time, and I just appreciate the people that are around me. I don't think too much about, you know, trying to attain worldly things anymore. You know what I mean? Like, of course, I'm always going to be striving to succeed in whatever it is that I do, but I'm just very content at this point in time right now to have time with my son and my wife and just be able to just create beautiful memories with them. You know, like, I'm enjoying taking my son everywhere that I go now. I try to take my son with me. I enjoy taking him with me. I enjoy having him there by my side. You know, I mean, it makes me happy.
Yeah, I suppose what you're looking at is it's still good to be ambitious and driven, but not necessarily motivated by the material stuff.
Definitely. I'm not motivated by material anymore. My motivation is something different now. My motivation now is to make beautiful memories with my wife and my son. You know what I mean? The minute that we get this clearance to start traveling, you know what I mean? That's exactly what I want to do. I want to travel the world and just have as much fun as I can with my wife and my son, create beautiful memories and just, you know, make sure that my son remembers that his childhood was beautiful, man. That's what I want.
How long might it be until you get the possible clearance?
So I think, you know, now, like, I just got to wait for the next checkup, which is in a couple of months. And then after that, I should be good, man. Like, as I said to you, I'm not in the best of health just yet. But I'm sure that I'll get there, you know what I mean? I'll get there, and hopefully with God's permission, I will get there. And once we get that clearance, we've got plans on going to Saudi Arabia and then doing a pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia just to thank God for my health and for everything that he's given us. And then, you know, we may go to Dubai, may go past England, visit Princess Mohammed and his family. And there's so many exciting things that we want to do, you know, go to Lebanon, just really exciting things to come, you know what I mean? And that's what we're going to do.
Great, Billy. Well, look, I'm really glad we managed to get this done. And I'm even more happy, obviously, with the news from a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, it's been great to spend some time with you. And thank you so much. I'm grateful.
Thank you, Tris. I appreciate your time, man. And to all the listeners out there, I just want to say thank you so much for all your prayers, all your supplication. I can't thank you all enough, you know, because that definitely makes a difference. I know that, you know, in our faith, we believe that one's decree can be changed with prayer and supplication. And I'm sure with all your prayer and supplication, that's why I'm here today, you know, God, with God's permission. And I just want to tell you all that I'm grateful and I love you all from the bottom of my heart.
And also big thanks to our mutual friend, Mike Altamura, who, by the way, was talking about your resilience and commitment to the sport, let alone to life, which has obviously been magnified massively. But man, thank you so much, Billy. I'm grateful.
Thank you, brother. You take care. God bless.
Take care. All right. Bye-bye. Bye.
Sometimes you just get inspirational guests. I mentioned Robert Diaz at the start. Go back and check out the Gary Belletto episode as well if you want to feel gratitude for life. I can't recommend that one enough, Gary Belletto. Billy was everything I hoped for and more. He's still struggling in the aftermath of the chemo, the treatment, the stress and strain and everything else. So to manage more than an hour of me was fabulous, and I'm super grateful. I'm also grateful to my sponsors, Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. Don't forget, if you guys enjoy this podcast, and I really hope you do, jump on patreon.com/TrisDixon to unlock episodes early and find bonus content up there. We're also due a Zoom catch-up soon. I hope to have a good guest on that. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Hanson Lee Resourcing, and huge thanks to the incredible Billy Dibb, and I'll be back next week.